Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
Trump just kind of tweeted, like, whatever. Hello, welcome to another episode of Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, joined today by Jane Costin, and as a special guest, Alex Ward, national security correspondent from the foreign team. And we wanted to talk about Iran. It seems like the dust is, to some extent, settling on that conflict. I am glad that it has not spiraled into a huge military conflict. And, you know, we can try to look back, see what we learned, see where we are now. I feel like one thing that we have learned is that after several days of vigorous protestation, that there was an imminent threat from Soleimani, that attacks were disrupted in some direct sense and lives saved. Donald Trump seemed to be backing off that a little bit on Twitter, retreating to sort of like, well, he's a bad guy, so who cares, which seems to make more sense to me in some ways. But Mike Pompeo is still really owning these talking points, which I guess he came up with in the first place.
Yeah. So the day after the strike, he goes on CNN and says there was an imminent attack, and that's why we went after it. And I should also say that the Pentagon, on the day that we killed Soleimani, or that the U.S. killed Soleimani, the Pentagon basically made two arguments. The first was that this was because, you know, we were worried about Soleimani coming after Americans, we're defending U.S. citizens in the region, and we're trying to deter future Iranian aggression. And then Pompeo comes out the next day and says, this is to foil an imminent attack. Look, I'm 80% of the way there and thinking this is all BS, right? And most of it comes from the fact that this administration can't keep its story straight. And they're saying, you know, well, we don't know the time, place, you know, who, why, when. Okay, that's important. But at the same time, like, Soleimani was always planning attacks against Americans. And so, and when I've talked to people inside the White House who are nonpartisan, they'll tell me, like, 100% there was intelligence showing that something was happening. So I don't doubt that Soleimani was planning something against the United States. What I mostly doubt is that it was happening soon, that it was going to be at four embassies, right? That we just don't have the specificity of what it was. And yet the administration has based its entire legal argument on that imminence. And we can talk about why that matters down the line. Wait.
Yeah, I think that that's something that I do want to get at, because I think that there's been a lot of kind of back and forth about whether or not the attack was justified because Soleimani was bad enough. And so you've seen a lot of Republicans kind of hitting back at Democrats who were hesitant about this because you're like, oh, you must love terrorists. And I'm like, you know, if we're going to do 2003 over again, I would really prefer we didn't.
I love terrorists.
Awesome, Matt. But I do think that it's worth saying that for a host of 2020 candidates, the argument has not been like, this was an awesome person that we killed. The argument has been, why and with what authorization? And that's actually what you're starting to hear from at least— well, okay, for Republicans, this is a large number, from at least three Republicans. So that's Matt Gaetz and Rand Paul and Mike Lee, who all of whom, when you know they had their meeting in which the administration attempted to explain their justification for why this happened, came out of that meeting saying, that was a terrible meeting, we don't understand what's going on. But I actually do think that we should get to, why does imminence matter here?
To take a quick step back, and I will get to that, is there are two levels of law we've got to consider. There's domestic law, and there's international law. That question you've just asked is a matter of international law.
Ooh.
So Article 51 of the UN Charter effectively states, I'm not going to do the whole thing, but it effectively states that that a country can do an attack on another country in self-defense. So the argument being that Soleimani was planning attacks on Americans, and if it weren't for the strike on him, you know, Americans would have died. Other ways that the U.S. could have made a legal case was if Iraq had given authorization for the strike, which it did not, or if the U.N. Security Council had given an authorization, which it did not. So it only had this imminence/self-defense thing to go on. So that's why I think the administration is pushing so hard on this imminence, is because it's as a matter of international law, it needs to prove that that is true. Domestic law is a lot, actually weirdly more complicated, because then we get into the whole issue of Article 2 of the Constitution, which the president is the commander-in-chief, leader of the armed forces, can do basically what he at this point wants with it. And then when we get to the War Powers Resolution 1973, then it gets to this whole situation of, well, the president has 48 hours to tell Congress about, you know, an operation, and if he doesn't, then hostilities have to end after 60 days. And this has been a constant battle of whether the War Powers Resolution is actually unconstitutional. The Trump administration's argument, at least domestically, is the president, commander-in-chief, Article 2 of the Constitution, I get to do what I want. That's all well and good. That's a fair argument in many lawyers' minds. And so even though I think the complication in terms of law is on the domestic side, the administration has actually gotten itself twisted on the international law side.
Right. I mean, because this relates to the fact that this is a strike that took place in Iraq, and there is been a considerable diplomatic fallout with the Iraqi government related to this. Clearly, we did not feel like looping them in on this operation for, I guess, operational security reasons. Also, the Iraqi government does not take the same view of the Iranian government that we do,
right?
And probably wouldn't have given it the go-ahead, right? So but we want to keep our bases there. Like we want to still be cool with the Iraqis. So it's created a sort of a complex situation there, and I think it's fairly clear that however one exactly draws the lines around the imminence or not, right, that the strategic calculus here was not about forestalling some incredibly specific plot, right? This was, we've now had a lot of reporting that this is a move that was under consideration for months, that as often happens in the interagency process, different people had different opinions about whether this was a good idea or not. Mike Pompeo was really excited about it and, you know, like eventually won the argument, right? But like the U.S.-Iranian hostilities is a very old story, right? Going back to the 70s, the Trump administration ratcheting of that up has been going on for a couple of years. And this was a calculated move in that sort of Trump-Iran chess game, I think, more than a spur-of-the-moment defensive action.
No, I totally agree. I mean, Trump has been, to his credit, pretty consistent on my red line is when Iran kills an American. That's when I respond forcefully. Then he equivocates on whether it's going to be proportionate or disproportionate, but still, he's like, I will respond forcefully. Iran does kill an American contractor in Iraq in late December. We respond by hitting five of this Iranian-backed militia's sites in Iraq and Syria. They're the ones that killed the contractor. Then that group, Kataib Hezbollah, organizes the siege against the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, and then Trump goes, time to hit Soleimani. Game time. And this was something, as you alluded to, that Trump had authorized, according to certain reports, last summer. Right? And he said he authorized it with the caveat that Iran had to kill an American.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe the administration, in a way, has been telling us all along that we did this to deter Iran, that they thought this would be such a big hit that Iran would not do the big ones, the big attack against us, that we would deter a larger aggression. And I think the imminent case, they got backed into a corner, one, because of Pompeo's comments, but two, because of that international law thing.
Right. And so, I mean, I think you have to say, looking back on this after several tense days and a lot of questions, this has basically worked, right? Like on its own terms.
Well, I feel like one thing that I'm very hesitant about is that I don't know. We don't know yet if it has worked. I feel as if like
yes.
From and this has been kind of in the background for all of this is for the kind of anti-war conservatives and anti-war people in general. The kind of the degree to which, and I think that in some part this is the administration's fault for deciding that we need to believe intelligence after we weren't supposed to believe intelligence like 2 weeks ago. But I think that I do not want us to get to a mission accomplished moment Because that ended badly the last time.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a question of, like, mission accomplished, because it's a question of, I think it's a very legitimate question of what are we trying to accomplish with this Iran policy. But, like, over the two-month time horizon, there had been an escalation. And one thing that was plausibly on the table, like, 20 minutes after Soleimani's death, was that we were now going to see further escalation. But instead, we didn't see that, right? The Iranians did a strike back, did not kill any Americans, said, like, we're done with this if you're done. And the Trump administration more or less took yes for an answer on that.
Yeah, but I'll be honest, I don't think the Iranians missed on purpose, as was some of the narrative. I mean,
right.
Just I think they tried to kill Americans. They didn't. Part of that was because Americans took really good precautions. I mean, they were in bunkers. They left some of the most important buildings of Al-Asad Air Base. And I think the Iranians, I mean, based on what the Iranians hit, they hit like a helicopter depot. They hit a place where, you know, troops hung out.
Right.
Like, they tried to kill people.
But the Iranians could have said, these missiles
bigger.
Will keep flying until blah,
right.
blah, blah. But instead, they were like, we took our shot. We would like to calm down.
Yeah, and I think that, yeah, that's right. And so I do think so classic deterrence theory, right? Is if the first question you have to ask is deterring whom from doing what? Well, the whom is obviously Iran. Deterring what? I think it's the big attack, right? So the proverbial four embassy attack or something bigger. For now, I think we've deterred that. I think Iran's response, what it showed us is they're still going to respond, but not in a massive way. I mean, they have way more capabilities than they showed in that attack on Erbil and al-Assad. So I think Trump was successful in the short term of deterring the big attack. Iran's going to respond still with cyber operations, with proxy attacks, possibly still in a longer term scheme to kill someone who's like the American equivalent of Soleimani. That's all still on the table. So this conflict, as it has since 1979, continues. But I think we can say with some margin of confidence for now that Trump did deter the big attack.
Can we explain this proxies thing? Because the distinction actually seems important and sometimes gets sort of muddied by hawks, right? But, I mean, one of the things that was striking about the missile attack and the American bombing is that this was direct engagement by American forces with Iranian forces, which is new and unusual, even though there have been plenty of sort of Iran-related clashes.
No, exactly. Iran's response was the missiles flew from its territory, and they took responsibility for it, which was against the grain of how they've operated for a long time. In fact, so these proxy forces, I'm going to very much simplify this, but these proxy forces were Shia militias that Iran put under its own umbrella and let them loose to go after Sunnis in Iraq, go after Americans. And that's most of the reason why Soleimani has so many dead Americans on his hands, is that these Shia militias went out, killed troops, set off explosive devices, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. But so when people say Soleimani has blood of thousands
that's
of
what
Americans,
they're talking about.
What they mean is that Iran does what we would call, like, training and equipment operations with Shiite groups in Iraq and Lebanon, right?
Well, part of it, and they also is there's a question about how much direct control they have over that.
Right.
So, like, is Tehran telling Kataib Hezbollah, go kill that American contractor? A lot of American officials would say, yes, they're in direct orders. Others would say, well, it's looser. And it kind of depends on which militia. But that's part of it. And the reason Iran likes that strategy is because it's deniable.
Right.
Oh, the militias did it, not us.
Right?
That's why they do it. So the fact that Iran not only shot missiles from its territory and then took credit for it, that's why that was such a big deal, is that that was a direct Iranian attack on America.
Right. And the American position, right? Our attack on Soleimani is the Trump administration taking the view that the Iranian government is fully responsible for the actions of these militias.
Definitely.
Which is a, you know, that's an interpretation some people have of the events, but it's not a totally unambiguous question in the way that, like, here we are putting our button on missiles is, right?
Yeah, I mean, this was a direct U.S.-Iran confrontation, whereas before it was sort of like, yes, the U.S. and Iran have been at war, but it's because of a proxy thing, and, like, this was as most direct as we've had.
So something that's interesting is that when we're talking about the, you know, whether it's proxies or whether it's direct, one of the challenges that we're dealing with now is how much of this is based on, I feel like there are three separate issues. There's what happened, and then there's how what happened is being interpreted through the media to observers. And I think that something that I want to ask you is what questions do you still have about what took place and how much we know about either the actions that we took regarding Soleimani or the actions that, you know, the Iranians took regarding that missile attack. Because I think that a lot, you know, again, the intelligence that has been given even to members of Congress, as Mike Lee said, which is why he said that he was going to sign on to Tim Kaine's War Powers Resolution, the War Powers Resolution, which was enacted over Nixon's veto after the bombings in Cambodia in the early 1970s. You know, what questions do you still have? And you know, where do we go from here?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'd like to know the specificity of the intelligence, as would anyone, right? That got a little muddled yesterday. There's a CNN interview with Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who's not necessarily a fan of Trump's foreign policy, in which he told Jake Tapper that actually, yes, the in that briefing on the House, they did give us like a time and a specific sort of here's what the attack, you know, where it was going to happen, when it was going to happen. And that's new. I hadn't heard that before. So I'm now going to start after this, going to start digging into that. Because the people I talked to, the lawmakers and staff in the room during that briefing in the House and Senate, was there was nothing. Like they could have learned as much from a Vox.com article as they could have from that briefing. So the questions I have.
Vox articles are really good.
I know
just
they are.
To be clear.
No, that's my point. But like, I want to know why the decision was made to take credit for the Soleimani strike. Because we could have, like, not taken credit for it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We could have let Iran know or let them think, well, yeah, it's probably the Americans, but we don't know. They're not taking credit for it. Could have been the Israelis. We could have done it through, like, CIA law, like Title 50, I believe it is, instead of Title 10, which
right,
is DOD.
That would have been the classy way to do it. Right?
Kind of.
Like, it would have been pretty obvious what had happened, but, like, who's to say?
Right. It would have been deniable, and I think it would have been harder for Iran to respond in the way that it has, and I think the escalation could have been avoided. So I'm wondering why that decision was made. And then the other question I really have is, why didn't Trump choose what I actually thought was the more extreme option of targeting Iranian missile sites or ships? Because per reports, that was offered to him. The way this narrative has spun out is, well, he chose the most extreme. He killed Soleimani. I feel like bombing inside Iranian territory would have been worse.
Yeah.
I feel like bombing missile sites inside of Iran would have been worse. I feel like bombing Iran's navy would have been worse. He was given that option. Instead, he was like, I'm taking out Soleimani.
No, I mean, it would be interesting to know why he picked. And also, it would be interesting to know why the people presenting the options decided that this was the more extreme option, if that reporting is correct.
Yeah,
right?
I kind of question the reporting, to be honest, especially since Trump had been talking about it since 2017. Been talking about it since 2017, then they're going to give him that option.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know. Okay. So let's take a break and then we should talk about sort of what we see going forward here.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media. Pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context. And it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I want to back up just a little bit because I think that we've been talking about, you know, this has been an option for Trump since 2017. Obviously, U.S.-Iranian relations haven't really been that great since 1953 or so. But I want to back up just a little bit because there's a storyline that gets us to Soleimani or that takes place over the last 10 months. Can you tell us a little bit more about how we got to this point and just kind of the, like, you know, the increasing back and forth, the sending more troops to defend Saudi oil fields, which I think a lot of people responded to with kind of hesitancy. Can you explain a little bit about how did we get to this point over the last year or so?
Yeah, so I'm sure some conservative critics will come after me for this, but I think this starts in May 2018. May 2018 is when Trump removed the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal.
Right.
So over the next year or so, Iran's response is, well, we're going to try to work diplomatically. We're going to try to work with the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese in the deal to still continue to allow money to flow into Iran. Because the basics of the deal was Iran got restrictions on its nuclear program and in exchange was allowed to kind of trade and do business again with countries. It didn't really work. The Europeans, over time, they worked on this like sort of fake barter system, which is complicated to explain, but the Iranians weren't satisfied, so they start lashing out. They bomb an oil tanker. Very likely, it's not. Again, speak of deniability, they didn't take credit for it, but it was them. Like, who else was it? Right.
Right.
So it was the Iranians. They bomb an oil tanker in international waters. Then they, do it again. They bomb a Saudi oil field. They down an American military drone. And it should be said that this entire time, Trump is not responding forcefully. Like, he's, you know, saying, you know, we will come after you. Be careful. Don't attack Americans. He is sanctioning Iran, but he is not responding with military force. And there are people within the administration, including Pompeo and others, telling him, you need to respond forcefully. Otherwise, it's going to keep escalating. And again, as I mentioned before, his red line was do not kill an American. And Iran, well, an Iranian-backed proxy, but Iran finally crosses that line. And that's how we got to this strike. And what I always want to say at this point is I do believe that this, of course, starts with the Iran nuclear deal. I don't think we would be in this entire situation if Trump didn't withdraw. We could be with some hostilities, but not here. But I always want to point out that Iran didn't have to respond this way. Like, it didn't have to start bombing tankers. It didn't have to start bombing Saudi oil fields. It didn't have to down an American military drone. There were other options at its disposal. And so I'm not trying to do like an equivalence thing. I'm just saying that this was a choice that Iran made as a policy option to start doing these things, and it had to know what it was risking.
So I actually think a little left out. You mentioned this, right? But I kind of feel like the key decision makers here, or rather not decision makers, are actually the European JCPOA members, because there have been a whole sort of onion-like assemblage of sanctions on Iran over the years, right? Where the United States had a lot of sanctions on Iran going back to the embassy and the hostages and things like that. And then the nuclear issue comes to the fore, and all this diplomacy goes into getting other countries to also sanction Iran, because unilateral sanctions are a lot less potent than multilateral sanctions. And that really puts the squeeze on Iran, right? And it's hurting them badly. And so they make these nuclear concessions in exchange for sanctions relief. And the Obama administration in that deal, it keeps the like old U.S. sanctions on, because those were never about the nuclear program. But they're supposed to get relief from this tight multilateral noose, right? Then the Trump administration pulls out of the deal. And at first blush, my thinking was, this is a crazy strategy, right? Because we're not going to get the Europeans to go back to their Obama-era sanctions based on Trump doing something they told him not to do. So now the Iranians sort of get off scot-free, right? Like, we have just fucked up this sanctions web that had been painstakingly constructed. But Trump does something more aggressive than the Bush administration or anybody else ever had done, which is he uses the fact that the global payments clearing system is located in New York City, right, to effectively internationalize U.S. sanctions on Iran. So even though foreign countries aren't sanctioning Iran and they can do business with them, Iranian companies can't do any currency exchange, right? So in effect, Iran can't do any trade with anybody, anywhere. That's been something the U.S. has always sort of theoretically been able to do to countries, but we just, like, we don't, right? So, like, an American can't just, like, go on a vacation to Cuba, right? But a Spanish person can. And we are not using our control of the banking system to prevent that commerce from happening. But we're doing it to Iran, right? And so the Iranians spent all this time trying to get the Europeans to work something out, right? To come up with some kind of a workaround on this. And the Europeans didn't do it, right? Even as they keep saying that they don't agree with the Trump administration's policy and that they want Iran to keep following the terms of the nuclear agreement, they are not doing anything. Right. And while I obviously I wouldn't say that leaves the Iranians with no choice, because, you know, you always have a choice in life. They are, I mean, it's very typically European to sort of be like sitting there, like talking a lot and not taking any steps. But they are like not risking a confrontation with the United States by blowing up these financial sanctions. But they're also creating a situation in which Iran is not getting any upside from following the nuclear deal. And it's like a very unstable, like it's an inherently unstable situation that I think, like, on the one hand, it's Trump's fault because, like, I don't agree with his policy. But, like, at least Trump agrees with Trump's policy. Whereas, like, the Europeans, I don't know what they think is going to happen here.
It should be said that in the early parts of the Trump administration, Brian Hook, who's the special representative for Iran now, he was dispatched to Europe constantly,
right,
to work with the Europeans to expand the nuclear deal, which is what Trump wanted. Now, that meant including, like, you know, no more missile tests, no more support for terrorism, no nuclear weapons whatsoever, like, cancel it completely, this program. And what the administration is asking for is really a sea change in Iran's foreign policy. Like, change everything about yourself. And that was always maximalist and never going to happen. But there was at least a possibility, I wouldn't say high, but a possibility that Iran could have come to the table and said, okay, fine, we'll give you the X, you know, X thing more. And Trump probably could have said it was a victory. The Europeans would be happy. The Europeans did try to play kind of both sides a little bit. I agree with you on that. They did try to work on this barter system with Iran to keep that money flowing. And then they also kind of tried to play Trump, being like, oh, we're definitely making progress on this expanded deal. And the thing that I like is, again, like I said, Brian Hook was leading this charge. Macron is in a meeting with Trump and says, like, oh, our deal that we're working with Brian Hook is going very well. And Trump goes, who's Brian Hook? So, like, you know, all this to say is that I think there was a half-hearted effort by the Europeans. It should be noted, just today, before we were recording, France, Germany, and the UK put out a statement saying that Iran, and I should have mentioned this earlier, Iran is also starting to unshackle itself from the restrictions of the nuclear deal. It's starting to inch very little, but inching closer to potentially getting a bomb. And so they are basically using the JCPOA as it was intended, which is using this dispute mechanism to say, you're bad, right? You're not following the rules. And so we may reimpose these UN multilateral sanctions if you don't follow. So I feel like the Europeans have kind of come more to the U.S. side, but mostly in part because of Iran's actions.
Right. But it is, anyway, long story short, I want to be honest with this because I don't agree with Trump's trajectory on this topic. I think he should have stuck with the nuclear deal. I think it's a very dangerous course of action he's pursuing. But events do seem to be mostly falling out in the way that American Iran hawks would have wanted. That, like, these keep being sort of knife's edge things where killing Soleimani could have spiraled out of control, but it didn't, right?
But I feel like that's partly – that has less to do with Trump and more to do with Iran responding by allegedly accidentally shooting down a passenger plane.
Well, then, like, I was going to say
several
politically,
days later,
it, like, seemed initially like the Iranians had actually, like – we're going to reconsolidate political control when
right.
they were facing a lot of protests, but instead they shot a plane full of Iranian civilians by accident and now have, like, big political problems on their hands. The Europeans, like, don't approve of this course of action Trump is undertaking, but they're sort of getting dragged along closer to his point of view when it could have gone the opposite way, right? They could have come up with some, like, Bitcoin thing in which the Iranians could do their oil exports. And they may, you know, someday if American governments keep using sanctions in this way, but they're not so far. So, I mean, I do feel like if you accept the premise that the Iranian regime is like the worst thing ever and the United States of America should be running like huge risks to try to keep them down, like this is kind of working.
A little bit. I mean, yeah. Sure.
I mean, it's not getting them to give up their support for
right,
all these groups, so.
Well, that's the thing is, like, the Trump administration's own metric is that was these 12 policy options that Pompeo laid out. And they're some of the ones that I just briefly outlined.
It's like no missiles, no Hezbollah, no enrichment whatsoever.
Pretty much, right? So, okay, I don't see any real movement on any of these. If anything, all this has done is incentivize Iran to want a nuclear weapon. All this has done is want Iran to improve its missile program. All this has done is probably want to get them to support terrorism more.
Well, definitely the nuclear weapon, right?
I mean, definitely the nuclear weapon. I mean, Kim Jong-un right now is looking at this and being like, I have made the smartest decision I've ever made, right? Keep the nukes, improve the nukes, lie to the Americans, be friendly with Trump, move forward. And the Iranians are now going like, man, we should have really gotten this weapon earlier.
And I'm not sure if people fully understand, right? But like across, because this, you know, after 9/11, right? Like Al-Qaeda was an important topic and also nuclear proliferation was very much in the news. But if you look across the board at the differing trajectories of like North Korea, Iraq, Libya, and Iran, right? Like American policy seems to be pretty clearly saying that like what you want to do is get yourself nuclear weapons.
Totally.
Right.
Right? Which was not, like, none of the various presidents have had that as their stated policy, but it's what they're doing, right? Like, Gaddafi gives up nuclear weapons. We help overthrow his government when he is in trouble domestically. North Korea is, like, doing happy summits with Trump because they have nuclear weapons. Iran makes a deal to control their nuclear weapons, and then we just kind of welch on it. And, you know, Saddam's gone. He never had nuclear weapons. So it seems like you should, like, really try to do what you can to get some.
And then be friendly with Trump. And then if you cause an American citizen to become brain dead, you can just be like, who knew? How did that happen? But I want to go back quickly. Something I think that got missed for some people, perhaps, is how Iraq played into this and the letters sent regarding the United States staying in Iraq despite Iraq perhaps in a not legally binding manner, asking the American military to leave, maybe. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So after the Soleimani strike, Iraq's parliament passes a non-binding vote saying that they want U.S. troops gone. This is approved and championed by the caretaker prime minister. And it should be noted that this vote was taken kind of like via, you know, certain lines, like there were mostly Shia lawmakers in the parliament that are mostly aligned with Iran. And so, you know, the Sunni lawmakers weren't there in the big numbers. Some say there wasn't as big a quorum as it should have been. But whatever, the vote passed. It was non-binding. But the clear implication is that Iraq, especially Iraq's leader for the moment, wants the U.S. gone. Then there's this letter that leaks out of nowhere saying that American brigadier general had written that basically was like, okay, well, we're repositioning, we're moving troops out, and it was unsigned, and it leaks. And then you have Mark Esper, the defense secretary, and General Mark Milley, the Joint Chiefs chairman, come out and be like, wait, no, that's not a thing. We never sent it. And if we did, it was a mistake. And the Iraqis like, we got the letter. Like, what do you want us to do? We're expecting you to leave. And this is just, this whole thing was muddled. But now then you have Trump being like, if they want to kick us out, we're going to sanction Iraq. So now he's going to sanction Iraq to keep troops in the Middle East. We've sent 3,000 troops to the Middle East, I believe Kuwait, some to Saudi perhaps, in order to bolster our defenses and as a show of force. And so it's just this weird situation where we've now basically, the country that we helped, quote unquote, get to this point, Iraq, now wants us very much gone. And that could hurt our fight against ISIS there. It would further embolden Iran and move Iraq closer to Iran. And it would weaken America's foothold in the Middle East. So, smart move.
Great. Mm. All right. Let's take another break and talk more about this bigger regional picture.
This week on The Pitch, would you like fries with that?
People are what make franchises run.
The person who knows the business inside and out. Yep. Not someone who came off Wall Street because their check clears. Franchairs is the first investment marketplace where people can invest in franchises.
So you said $800 billion is what this market is a year. And hundreds of businesses are actually franchised businesses.
Thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
There are more brands franchised than there are stocks on the NASDAQ.
Oh.
You're raising a $4 million price round.
And what are the terms on that?
The $19 million post-money valuation.
Oh, really?
And do you not think that the valuation is a little frothy?
This week, things get frothy when Kenny Rose brings a new alternative investment class to retail investors. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I mean, this to me is the sort of crux of the matter, right? Which is that the U.S. has this big military presence in the Middle East. We have had it for years now. Trump keeps saying he wants to not do that. But in practice, we're sending more troops constantly.
Yeah. Yep.
Rather than
fewer. There are more boots on more ground. And, I think that it's been interesting attempting to interpret Trump's militarism. And I think it's useful to do so on its own merits and not on what was projected upon him in 2016 when he was like, I'm anti-war, but also bomb the shit out of everybody. It's worth just keeping it like more people are being sent to the Middle East. And there is more engagement there.
But
that's what's happening.
So I watched his interview with Laura Ingraham, which was interesting. Because
I bet it was.
She's she's a very pro-Trump kind of figure. But they got into it a little bit about this, where she was like, well, you said you were going to take troops out of Syria, but they're still there. And then he says, like, no, they're just there because they're taking the oil. And then he's like, well, no, they're not they're not taking the oil. They're like guarding a part of the country that has oil in it. And he's like, well, taking the oil, guarding the oil, what's the difference? But it's totally different, right? I mean, you can't take the oil for many logistical reasons,
legal
international
reasons,
law reasons, basic common sense. I mean, you can't move an oil field. That's the whole nature of oil fields. But, you know, Trump does seem invested on some level in the idea that he wants to reduce the American military footprint in the Middle East, but he's like really not doing it, right? Like when the Iraqis were like, all right, we want you out, like he could have said,
great,
fair enough.
Yep. Yeah. No, that's
you know, like
oh,
if you don't want if you don't want our help, like that's okay. Like we were trying to be helpful, but we are also happy to go. But instead he's like, no, I mean, we're just refusing to leave, right?
At this point, I mean, we have not been officially kicked out.
Okay.
We have not been officially kicked out, let's be clear. But Trump is trying to signal, you cannot officially kick us out, and we won't leave even if you do. I mean, Pompeo said that as well, like, we're not leaving. Like, deal with it, Iraq. And the reasons are kind of twofold. One is that the administration feels that it is important for U.S. troops to be there in order to keep ISIS down, right? Trump does not want a resurgence of ISIS on his watch. I don't think anyone does. And then the other part of it is, and this is in Iraq and Syria, and then the other part of it, of course, is this oil fields thing, as you mentioned. And also just keeping our general sort of foothold in Iraq. Trump has also occasionally said, like, he wants troops there in order to watch Iran. I don't know what watch Iran means, but this is sort of his play. And I think for him, to Jane's point, I think when we analyze Trump, he does not want the big war. He does not want to go all in for years, but he doesn't mind, you know, getting to a scuffle. He doesn't mind bombing a few things. He doesn't mind going after terrorists. He doesn't mind increasing our rate of airstrikes around the world. I mean, gosh, we're in war in Somalia, as far as I know, and no one's talking about that either. So
we never talk about the Horn of Africa enough, and especially because al-Shabaab has been increasing its activities.
They just killed Americans there.
Yeah, they a separate podcast.
But well, this is also, though, like, I saw, I don't know how to say his name, Mark Dubowitz, yeah. Finnish for Defense of Democracy. So he was on TV recently, because this is how people try to communicate with Trump. You know, so this is a guy's big-time Iran hawk, right? And he is trying to make the pitch that, like, you can be very hawkish on Iran without doing the stuff that, like, Trump, that people leery of war are afraid of. And so he's saying, like, no nation building, no boots on the ground, but we're going to hit them hard, right? And this is like, you know, Jane, you were talking about things people project onto Trump.
Right.
And I think the issue is that to people who are on the left, right,
military options exist in like a certain spectrum of conception, right? But Trump is obviously not on the left, right? And so he's in another world in which the problem, he has some doubts about war, but those doubts have nothing to do with killing foreigners.
Oh, absolutely not.
Right? So to the extent that you can reassure him, I have a plan to kill lots of foreigners without endangering Americans, right? Like by dropping bombs on them from far away. Like, he's really excited about that, right? And, like, drones, where, like, literally there's no human being in the vicinity. Like, that's really good for him. And so, you know, Dibowitz is, like, trying to sell him on a vision where, like, we can have this confrontation with Iran, but, like, also not really be at war with Iran, which I think is hard because we do have so many assets on the ground in the Middle East that Iran can retaliate against. Like, we could withdraw to the other side of the world and, like, occasionally fly a plane over the country, but, like, that's not, like, at all what our actual posture is. Like, people are at risk constantly.
I mean, that's kind of the Israeli strategy, the Mollah strategy, right? Like, just constantly hit things and don't get so involved, but— you know, just keep bombing them until they, you know, until they grow back and bomb them again.
Right. Withdraw from Gaza.
Right.
But also we drop bombs on it all the time and control the perimeter.
I would say that I, just to really open the aperture here for a second, the Obama administration's argument kind of when it came to Iran, but just in a bunch of other things was, well, the second you get engaged in bombing or anything like that, then you're at war. Mm-hmm. Like it was kind of a red light, green light situation and that there was nothing in between. And I think the Trump administration—
old fashioned.
Yeah, I think the Trump administration rightly has noted that there are options in between, that that you can, I mean, for lack of a better, you can bomb things and not go to the full-scale war. I don't think it's not war. Like, you know, once you're bombing and killing people, that's war.
Yeah, that's a war.
That's a war.
If the bombs are falling on you, at least.
Right, that's a war. But, you know, they don't have to be World War II. They don't have to be World War III. They don't have to be this big skirmish. And I think that the Trump administration rightly noted that. And I think that they're looking for options, especially for the president, that fall short of, well, this would make us send, you know, 100,000 troops back to Iraq.
But in the limit, right, there's no real way to ensure that Iran doesn't build a nuclear weapon without—
Right, without inspections, which for now are still going on.
Oh, my God, we are doing 2003 all over again. We're going to find Hans Blix out of it somewhere. Like,
isn't he around?
Probably. I'm sure he is.
I mean, like, as long as the Iran nuclear deal exists, which right now it's starting to crumble, as Trump wants, but as long as it exists, there are restrictions on Iran and its nuclear capabilities. Of course, there are always charges that it's been cheating, and Iran in the moment is starting to inch away from those restrictions, but for the moment, they last. Yes, that is the only way to really assure that Iran doesn't get one, and on top of that, to not threaten it so much that it doesn't feel compelled to get it. And that's I think, the real weakness here, as we were talking earlier, of Trump's Iran policy, is that everything that we're doing towards Iran makes it trust the U.S. less, its word less, and has every incentive to try to safeguard itself. And one of the easiest ways to do that is to get a nuclear weapon. I should note, they have never officially said they want a nuclear weapon. They keep denying that they want one. They always say it's for science purposes. But there are experts who say, and it's hard to know what their breakout capability is, or timeline is, but experts are usually in the year mark.
How does this play in with, you know, I think that there's been a lot of reporting over the last couple of days about how, especially after the accidental missile attack on a passenger plane, the response from inside Iran has been with a great deal of understandable consternation and protest. How much does that impact what happens going forward? Because obviously, you know, Iran, like the United States, has a lot of people who are likely supportive of the regime and likely not supportive of the regime. We're hearing a lot more from the latter more recently, but how does that impact, in your view, what happens next from the regime's perspective? Do you think that that is another part of impetus to be like, okay, we're going to slow walk this?
I mean, I should note I'm not a domestic Iran expert, so take everything
I'm
I say
I'm asking you a lot of questions that you can respond to with I don't know.
I mean, I take everything I say with a grain of salt. I do think on the international front, the people advocating for that Soleimani strike or who wanted the U.S. to finally fight back against Iran after years of basically standing by, their argument is, well, that has stopped Iran from at least doing the big, as we talked about earlier, doing the big thing and maybe keeping Iran at bay internationally for a while. And so that would have given the U.S. some space to kind of go after regular Iranians or make the pitch to regular Iranians, hey, you know, this regime is bad for you, as we've been doing, but even more strong in a stronger way because we don't have to worry about the international aspect as much. But Iran did this for us, in a sense, by, quote unquote, accidentally shooting down the Ukraine airliner. Who knows if it's an accident, but that's the official statement from Tehran. And, look, Iranians have been protesting against this regime basically since 1979. Not everyone is enamored with it. A lot of people are against it. And what they seemed to not like, and again, this is just an outsider's view, but having talked to a couple experts about this, there seems to be kind of two feelings somewhat in tension in the Iranian populace. Not that it's a monolith, but just in general. The first is that they do not like when outsiders just kind of start to mess with their country, and who would? The second is they do not like it when the regime comes at them, which, and who would? And so they're constantly like fighting outside forces and inside forces, and this is almost the perfect synergy of both. And so the fact that after Soleimani, there were tons of Iranians, thousands of Iranians protesting against the U.S., angry at the U.S. for this happening, and then now a lot of those same people are going, and how dare you, Iranian regime, kill Iranians on this plane? And so it's kind of like a constant state of anger at this moment. But I don't really see like a green movement type fervor. I don't see that kind of mobilization. But who knows? Maybe this will springboard into something much bigger down the line.
Something that I think you see here is that Trump, throughout his career and across a variety of fields, he kind of likes these risky plays that often can work but seem to have small upsides, right? So like in a totally other sphere, right? If you look at what happened with the USMCA negotiations, right? Like basically Canada and Mexico made concessions to the American negotiating position, and in exchange we did nothing, right? And Trump also got the Chamber of Commerce to enthusiastically back the ratification of a trade deal that steps away from free trade positions that they would normally support. And the reason all these actors were like willing to get on board with Trump is that they didn't want him to tear up NAFTA, right? Which when he first announced it, you know, a lot of people in the chattering classes, the think tank realm, were like, this guy's crazy. Like, don't tear up NAFTA. That'll be terrible. But precisely because it's so terrible, ultimately, he got other people to give in, right? But then the other way of looking at it is like the concessions he got from both Canada and Mexico there, they're really, really small. You know, it was like this potential economic cataclysm, and it's over what, right? Like milk exports, whether copyright lasts 50 years or 60 years. So it's like, who cares, right? And it's one reason you're able to get the concessions is because ultimately he's willing to settle for so little. And the other reason you're able to get concessions, he's willing to like risk so much. And the Soleimani thing really reminded me of that, right? Where it was like, everybody had a couple days worth of takes of like, this could lead to like a horrifying conflagration. And it didn't, which is good. It seems to have quieted the Iranians down some, you know, which is his objective. But it hasn't like solved any of the big issues in the U.S.-Iranian relationship. But it's very potential. Like the downside risks here were really, really big. And the upside possibilities were small. Like it's worked out. There was no plausible scenario in which like Soleimani dies and now the supreme leader is like, you're right, we're cutting off Hezbollah.
Right.
Right. Like that didn't make sense. Whereas there was a plausible scenario in which the Iranian missiles hit a little bit differently, kill a bunch of Americans. Now we're striking back, right? And like tons of people are dying. And it's very, I mean, I don't know. Like, this is what everybody thought about Trump before he got elected, that, like, he seems like a very risk-friendly, impulsive guy.
Yeah, that was kind of part of the art of the deal,
right,
so to speak.
But it's worked out okay for him so far, you know? And it makes me nervous, you know, like a gambler on a hot streak, you know, who's, like, making bets that you know don't really make sense, right? Because I have never heard a like super convincing explanation of like, how is this Iran policy supposed to work, right? Like other than maybe protesters will overthrow the government, which like doesn't seem like a good thing to count on.
Well, that's what John Bolton surely wants. He's been very open about it since he left government. And Pompeo, I'm sure, secretly wants, and maybe not so secretly. I do think, you know, you're gambling point, I think, is correct. Before Trump decided to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, everyone was told him, do not do it. It's going to lead to widespread protests and strikes and attacks and anger. And he moved it, and it didn't really happen.
It was fine, right?
It was fine. Same thing. I'm sure tons of people told him, if you kill Soleimani, you know, this is going to escalate to massive amounts. And he did it. And I think not necessarily because of the strike, I think in part, but mostly because U.S. troops were very good at hunkering down and finding safe spaces. I mean, let's not minimize. People were wounded, right? Like some, according to some reports, some like got blown out of towers. So like it was violent, but because they, U.S. troops at Al-Asad Air Base did well and because Iran's attack was relatively weak, we're here. But Trump's luck could run out. Pretty easily.
And the embassy thing's a great point, right? Because it's like, on the one hand, like, none of those dire forecasts came true. On the other hand, like, for what?
Political gain.
Right.
And shoring up support with Israel. And, I mean, same thing. There are tons of people, and Jane can speak to this better than I can, but there are tons of people in the conservative base that have been wanting to hit Iran for a long time.
Right.
And finally, Trump is doing this. And what I worry is, you know, as we talked about earlier, Iran's not done. They are going to come back at some point. They're going to do something. They may now know that the red line would be enforced by Trump, but like the danger with Iran persists. And so I think the relationship has changed to a certain extent because we can never unkill Soleimani.
But what if we can?
Well, then Trump is the greatest president of all time.
Yeah, I think it's interesting though, because I think that one of the challenges here is we don't know. We don't know what's next. We don't know what's next from the Iranian perspective. And I think that that's why you're seeing so much continued anxiety is that all of, you know, I've seen some from kind of a more neoconservative perspective being like, oh, all the freaking out about how we're going to go to war or we're already at war was totally unwarranted. I'm like, we don't know that. And, you know, let's keep in mind that I think for both of us, we have been at war in Iraq and Afghanistan since we were both in high school. You know, I think that if past is prologue, that's bad. And so I also think that speaking from the conservatives I've spoken with, there's kind of that actually matches really well to recent polling that's been done over the last 2 days that people are supportive of, like, okay, striking through the money, good. Trump's strategy, bad. Do we understand it? No. Do we know what's going to come next? No idea. And I think I think it's worth noting that two things can be taking place at the same time. I think people can be understanding that the strike on Soleimani may have been a good idea, especially when the ongoing context of the back and forth between proxies, but also that it sets a precedent that is not good. Or is concerning at the very least.
And I do kind of just want to piggyback off that. I do want to take the Soleimani killing outside of Trump's strategy. Trump's strategy, mm-hmm. This maximum pressure is economic pressure on Iran to the point that it will come to the table. Killing Soleimani was not necessarily part of maximum strategy, maximum pressure. It was, we want the administration's bet that it could stop the cycle of violence that could have escalated to something much bigger and therefore started a bigger war. Maximum pressure continues. We don't know to what end. In fact, I thought until a couple days ago that Iran could possibly end this by just meeting with Trump, pulling a Kim Jong-un, right? Rouhani or whoever could meet with Trump, as Trump has wanted before, meet with him, maybe give him, like, say that there's a concession, you know, we will officially nuke some air, you know, nuclear site in Natanz or whatever.
Or buy some soybeans. Or
whatever
it is. You never know what Trump
And then
wants.
Trump goes, you know, there's no more threat from Iran, just kind of like it did with North Korea. Iran's not doing that for domestic purposes and other reasons, but I felt like that was a way out. And then Trump recently tweets, oh, I don't even care if they meet with me. That's not really the goal here. The goal is that they change everything about themselves. And then it's like, okay, well, then what is your strategy for? Right? This is my big issue, is that the Iranians, if you really want to deter Iran, have a strategy, be clear about what you want. This administration does not have that. But it seems that the gamble paid off on the Soleimani bit and just that bit alone.
Right. To put it a little outside the context of just the administration, because I do think people should always understand the difference between, like, what's Trump being weird and what's, like, the Republican Party. That more or less, I mean, this is orthodox conservative movement
totally.
Approach, as far as we know. If anything, Trump is a little less hawkish on Iran than
He's not for regime change, so yeah.
Right. I mean, then like Bolton, say, who's out there. I mean, and this has been, you know, I would say frustrating experience for years listening to critics of the nuclear deal, who I think often raise sort of like valid specific points, but don't ever seem to be able to outline like what is actually better. Like, what is a realistic accommodation that you can reach, because like the nature of an international conflict is that you resolve them with bad actors who you are at odds with, right? And if the demand is just like, well, our adversaries have to totally change in every way, then like, well, that's not going to happen, right? So like, what are we trying to do?
The Trump official I've talked to would say that Iran has never faced this kind of pressure before.
Sure.
That without this, that the U.S. has never placed this economic pressure, this now military pressure, that Iran will now, it will, and to be fair, Iran's economy is struggling really hard. It's headed towards recession. Like, that aspect has worked. The economic chokehold has worked. And the bet is that that will lead Iran to the table, and therefore they'll go, you're right, America. We need to change everything about ourselves in order for this to end. And there is no evidence to show yet. In fact, I would say the opposite, that bet is paying off.
And there's no real, I mean, history, right? I mean, you can look at North Korea, you can look at Cuba, right? I mean, there's no, I don't think there's like any real example of this like sanction the other guy into submission working.
The history of sanctions shows that it has to be a super targeted kind of thing to work, that you kind of need a small policy target. But this target is as big as it gets. It's Iran, change everything about yourself.
Right. This isn't like apartheid. This is like everything you do. But, you know, what was the quote yesterday? Like, why can't they be a normal country like Norway? Which
the obsession with Norway is insane to me. But
that's, again, a separate podcast topic.
All right. Trump in Norway next time on Weeds. But for now, thank you, Alex, for joining us. Thanks to Malachi, our engineer, Jackson Bierfeld, the producer. And Weeds will be back on Friday.